Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, and welcome to a new episode of Talking France, a podcast by the team at The Local. This week, we will talk about trains, croissants, the Le Pens, French bashing, and a sexy subject at the end, which I won't reveal yet. Yes, France is about to test a new 49 euro rail pass to encourage people to get onto trains. We'll explain who can take advantage of it and where you can use it and where you can't. Plus, it's 120 years of the Entente Cordiale between France and the UK. We will explore whether there's any real entente between the two countries these days and whether or not it's even cordial. And French far-right stalwart Jean-Marie Le Pen is a talking point this week. Does he deserve any credit for shaking up French politics in recent decades? Or is he just a racist who's in the right place at the right time? And people have been meddling with croissants again. We've had fish fingers and sausages in them. What on earth are they putting in these sacred pastries now? I'll give you a clue. It's been called a crookie. I'm Ben McPartland, your host. Joining me this week will be three of the finest minds at The Local France: Emma Pearson, Jen Mansfield, and John Litchfield. I should say they are the only minds at The Local France. But thanks for being with us, Emma, Jen, and John. Shall we crack straight on?
Let's do it, although I'm not talking to you after that.
Not to take anything away from you, but I just wanted to be transparent. Last year, Germany introduced a 49-euro rail pass, and before that, a 9-euro ticket to encourage people to use public transport. Both were hugely successful. People drove less, and experts estimated it resulted in a huge drop in carbon emissions. The ticket schemes boosted regional travel and local economies across the country. It wasn't long before France announced it wanted to copy its neighbour's idea. And after months of talks, we are a lot closer to the French 49 euro pass seeing the light of day. Tell us about this French version, Jen.
Well, to start off, it's going to take effect this summer. The tickets are going to go on sale starting on June 15th, but it's going to be quite different from the German rail pass. So the same principle is going through. There's still going to be a 49-euro rail pass that allows unlimited transportation on regional trains, what we know as the TER and Intercité train services in France. It won't be valid for travel on those high-speed TGV lines, but we weren't expecting that, and that was the same in Germany as well. And it's not quite clear yet whether it'll work on local public transport, such as trams and buses. As of April, it seemed like it was going to be limited just to the TER and Intercité trains.
Okay, so you can't just jump on a TGV high-speed train and expect to use this pass. That's one catch. There are some others. Jen, talk us through them.
Well, firstly, it's only going to be available for people under 27 years old. And secondly, Paris regional transport networks are not going to be included. So that means you won't be able to take the Transilien trains and the Paris metro using this pass. But you can still come to and from Paris from the surrounding regions. Hopefully, if the scheme is a success, then they'll add the trains inside of Paris into the mix next year. But local authorities said it would be too complicated this year with the Olympics and all.
Okay, now hold on. Only for under 27s. That's quite a big catch. Germany's ticket was for all ages. Why not France's?
Well, it likely has to do with cost. It was already really hard to get the regions on board with the plan. Plus, this summer is meant to be the test version. So if it's successful, they could end up extending it to everyone and making it outside of just the summer months too. France's Minister of Transport, Patrice Vergriete, told Parliament in March that their goal with the scheme is specifically to get young people to discover all of the regions in our beautiful country. And initially, Macron actually discussed being in favor of this plan while being interviewed by the famous Gen Z YouTuber Hugo Decrypt. So I presume young people have always been, you know, part of the focus with this plan.
Okay, so look, only for under 27s, no TGV trains, can't use it in the Paris region. Is there another catch, Jen?
Well, as I mentioned, this is just the first experimentation with the program. So like I said, it's only going to be available during the summer months of July and August. Originally, we thought it was going to go the whole year like the German version, but this is just going to be a short test.
Okay. If it goes well, is there a plan to extend it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just going to depend on how the program runs. So there were a lot of disputes amongst the regional authorities about just getting this first test up and running, largely because of budget issues. As things stand, the French government is going to foot 80% of the bill, and then the regions regions are going to have to pay the other 20%. The eventual goal is for the regions and the government to split it 50-50. But some of the region heads were really upset that Île-de-France, the Paris region, is not participating. And they said that it decreases the attractiveness of the scheme and they'll only participate again if the Paris region takes part. So really, we're just going to have to see how it goes this time and then if it gets renewed.
I mean, it definitely sounds like something worth checking out if you're under 27. Have you got a couple of examples of some decent trips you could do with this ticket, Jen?
Yes, I did look at a couple. So you can actually do this sort of cross-country trip from Nantes to Lyon, which seems really cool to me. There's also the Marseille-Toulouse-Bordeaux TER ride, which would be really cool to go from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic coast, passing through some of France's most popular southern cities. And then the 49 euro pass is actually also going to work on the nighttime Intercité trains. So you'd be able to go from Paris to Briançon in the Alps or from Paris to Nice, for example.
Okay, those both sound great. Now, I'm just over 27 years of age. Is there any other option for me apart from this ticket?
Yeah, I mean, SNCF does have plenty of RailPass deals on their website. There's the Carte Avantage Adulte, which costs 49 euro a year, and it helps you get discounted tickets on the high-speed TGV trains. Obviously, that's not quite as nice as the unlimited rail travel that you would get with that 49 euro pass that we were just talking about, but it's not a bad deal if you take the train a lot.
Okay, thanks, Jen. And look out for articles on our site. I'll share them in the podcast article and show notes about this 49 euro travel pass. Now, this week has been a very special anniversary of a pact of friendship between France and the UK, the signing of the Entente Cordiale on April the 8th, 1904. Before we move on, let's hear first what Emmanuel Macron had to say about it.
France and the United Kingdom don't only have a long history to celebrate, but also a shared future to build. Let's use the Entente Cordiale of the 21st century to nurture the friendship between our two peoples and the shared causes we promote in the world. Long live the Entente Cordiale and long live the Franco-British friendship.
Some nice words from the French President Emmanuel Macron there. This week, we've also seen French gendarmes taking on the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace in London, while British troops return the favour at the President's Elysee Palace here in Paris. Emma, to tell us all about the Entente Cordiale, fire away.
Okay, so for most of the previous millennia, the places that now make up the countries of France and the UK, I think it's fair to say we're not exactly busy mates. So Duke William of Normandy, he invaded England in 1066.
That's William the Conqueror.
That's William the Conqueror, right. Yes. Set himself up as the king and forced people to learn French, or maybe he forced people to learn Norman. I'm actually reading a really interesting book about this at the moment, but I think that's a whole other topic for maybe another episode.
Okay.
But then we have the Hundred Years' War, which, as the name suggests, lasted quite a long time, between the French and the English monarchs in the 1300s and the 1400s. We had religious wars in the 1600s, Napoleonic wars in the 1700s, taking us right up to the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. After that, the Franco-British tensions did calm slightly, and the French mostly got on with fighting their other neighbours, the Germans, through the Franco-Prussian Wars. And the Entente Cordiale was signed in 1904, and it's really just a series of agreements. It's not like a single formal diplomatic treaty. It's a series of agreements on quite small topics, actually, but it's kind of the international way of saying, like, let's be friends between two countries. On the British side, the treaty was strongly supported by the then king, Edward VII. He was a Francophile. He was a big fan of visits to Paris, and they say to Paris's brothels. But he was also worried about the ambitions of his nephew, the German Kaiser Wilhelm. And just 10 years after the Entente was signed, Europe, of course, was plunged into World War I, with France and Britain on the same side against the Germans. 25 years later, Europe is at war again, and once again, France and the UK were on the same side. And in the post-war period, France and the UK, they've certainly had their moments of tension, but the basic principle of the Entente has held, and the two countries remain allies.
Now, you mentioned there, Emma, some periods, moments of tension. Can you flag a couple up for us?
Yes. Well, you will recall, of course, Jacques Chirac refusing to join the US and UK invasion Iraq. The Sun newspaper did a front page of him made up to look like a worm.
Yes.
More recently, of course, the Brexit negotiations
were
particularly torturous.
I think, was it in those negotiations where President Macron apparently called Boris Johnson a clown?
Fair comment, I'd say.
Yes, apparently. British or former PM Liz the Lettuce Truss couldn't decide if Macron was a friend or foe. That didn't go down too well either. We've had problems with mad cows. Didn't the French ban British beef?
Yes, they did. And actually, British people in France still cannot give blood, which I did not realise the first time I went along to offer my blood to the French people. And they were like, oh, no, la vache folle. I was like, what? You're calling me a mad cow? A bit rude. But still no.
Yeah, we've also had, you know, regular French bashing by the British tabloids, which doesn't really get noticed in France. Lots of finger pointing about migrant boats in the Channel. We've even had fishing scallop wars in the Channel.
Yes, lots of fishing wars. You'll vaguely remember the Battle of Jersey.
Yes.
A couple of years ago.
Now, didn't the Brits threaten to send army boats? Or they did send an army boat. The French threatened to cut off electricity to the island. It all got a bit out of hand, didn't it?
It all got a bit lively, yes.
But look, things seem to have calmed down now. King Charles made his first state visit to France quite recently. Macron spoke eloquently about Queen Elizabeth after she passed away. What's the future for these relationships, Emma?
Well, actually, Macron did mention this in that video message that we heard a clip from earlier. In July, there is a meeting of what they call the European Political Community, and that will be hosted by the UK. This thing, it's a bit of a Macron pet project, actually, but the idea is to create a wider European community than just the members of the EU. So it includes EU members plus former members like the UK, non-members like Switzerland and Norway, and some future potential maybe members like Ukraine. And it gives them a forum to talk about subjects that affect the whole of the geographical continent of Europe. There are some ceremonial things coming up as well. This summer, France and the UK, among other nations, will take part in commemorations for the 80th anniversary of the D-Day landings in Normandy. There's already sort of events and expeditions about that happening in France. And there will, of course, be the usual sort of day-to-day cooperation, especially on military matters, which happens a lot.
Let's bring in John Litchfield now, our French politics expert. John, the leaders of France and the UK commemorating the 120 years of the Entente Cordiale. Apart from the pomp and ceremony and Macron making a nice video, John, does the Entente Cordiale really matter these days?
Well, the treaty that was signed in 1904, not at all. I mean, as Peter Ricketts, the former British ambassador to Paris, pointed out in a tweet thread this week, it actually is all about carving up Africa in between the two countries. Very little really that has any relevance today. Is rather sort of shameful text, in fact. So the Entente Cordiale is a sort of trope, really. It's a sort of phrase that's wheeled out often when the British and the French have been quarrelling about something. It's a way of saying, no, we love each other, really. But I mean, the Entente Cordiale, therefore, as a treaty is kind of meaningless, but I think the relationship of the two countries is always going to be important. I mean, we're big, similar-sized countries with 1,000 years or more of entwined history and interests which can't be prized apart, Brexit notwithstanding. We're neighbours, you know, we're like sisters that live next door to one another, always looking over the hedge and sort of seeing what the other is doing and sort of love each other, really, but are often quarrelling. So, you know, all that is more important than a treaty that was signed 120 years ago about carving out the spoils in Africa.
John, you mentioned the B word, Brexit. How badly has that damaged French-British relations, with Britain going its own way in Europe and Macron being very pro-European these days?
Well, it clearly has. I mean, you know, again, to quote someone else, Alex Taylor, the great British journalist based in France, points out it's been a real tear and a real shock to a lot of British people who live in France and love France, and British people who live in Britain and love France and love Europe. So yeah, it has. It's in a sense a far more important text, the sort of Brexit, than the Entente Cordiale in 2024. But, you know, the relationship between Britain and France will survive Brexit, and I think in some ways the sort of the insecurity in Europe at the moment brings the two countries together perhaps more strongly than has been evident in the recent past. You know, we are the two big nuclear powers in Europe, the only two nuclear powers in Western Europe, and we are the biggest defence forces in Europe, although not as strong as we should perhaps be or were once. So it's inevitable that the two countries will have to, I think, probably come together more ahead. Whether Brexit will be undone is another question, but I think there is a compulsion on Britain and France to agree on many things. And below Brexit, they already do. You know, the defence apparatus of the two countries are extremely entwined. The change of the Imperial Guard and the Coldstream Guards this week is symbolic not just for the Entente Cordiale, but how much cooperation there is already between the two militaries of the two countries, Brexit notwithstanding.
John, just a word on French bashing. You know, there's nothing really cordial about the British tabloids' view of France over the years. That kind of French bashing, though, we don't seem to give much notice to it in France, do we?
No, that's really always the odd thing about it. I think that people in Britain who don't know France assume that the French papers are sort of tearing away at Britain in the same way, and occasionally they do, and they have a pop and amused by something that's going on in Britain. But there isn't the sort of systematic stirring up of hatred towards France that you get in the Daily Mail or the Daily Express or the Sun or even some of the so-called more serious papers. That is not something new, though. It's not even Brexit-related. It's been going on as long as I've been going on in journalism, which is too many years to remember. So it can't really explain it, really. It's the tabloids somehow like to define Britishness as being opposed to something else rather than something positive in Britain. And because France is next door, it's the obvious thing to be opposed to and mark. It's a kind of jealousy as well. You know, I think jealousy about certain aspects of France and therefore trying to tear France down. I can't explain it. It's psychologically difficult to explain, and you don't find it in the French media. There's not even the beginnings of a sort of systematic British bashing in the French media that you get in the French British media towards France.
And finally, John, just maybe we can put something to bed. You still hear Britain's comment that, oh, Macron, he's anti-British, he's anti-UK. Is he really, John?
No, I don't. I've never thought that. I mean, you know, within France, Macron is seen as a kind of Anglo-Saxon intrusion, you know, someone who thinks much more like an American or a Briton than most French politicians do. It's rather odd that, therefore, he's seen as anti-British in the UK. I mean, it comes because he took a very strong line against Brexit, which he was absolutely entitled to do, to defend French and European interests. And therefore, that is seen by the papers we were talking about just now as being somehow anti-British to defend French interests. I've never detected any particular anti-Britishness in Macron. He's always been extremely warm, actually. I mean, the things he said about the late Queen before she died, after she died, the statement, rather sweet statement he made this week about the Entente Cordiale, all suggest that he's rather attracted to Britain and is rather a sort of fond of Britain, despite all the stuff that's been thrown at him and at France in recent years.
Now, don't dare mess with the sacred French croissant. That was essentially the message from the French when it was discovered that a cafe in England was selling croissants with a filling of fish fingers. One French journalist described it as a culinary monstrosity. Why do British people seem to have an overriding need to destroy all that is holy in this world, said the journalist at the time. Jen, someone else has been messing with the holy croissant once again, and this time it's a Frenchman. What's happened?
Okay, so we're talking about a recent trend called the crookie, and it's taken over France on social media, and honestly, it's maybe taken over the world too.
I haven't heard of this, Jen.
Well, maybe you're just not on social media enough.
Yeah, true.
Basically, it's a croissant filled with cookie dough, and it was invented by a Parisian pastry chef, Stéphane Louvard, in 2022.
Who's now known as the Crookie Monster.
You could say so. I don't know if he would like that, though. No. But it really took off last year in 2023 when a TikToker, Johan Paps, filmed himself testing one of Louvard's crookies. After that, it exploded on social media. And it's funny because AFP actually went and interviewed Louvard. Mm-hmm. And he said that he's had hundreds of people visiting his pastry shop. And most of them have been young women, you know, between 18 to 25, quote unquote, with smartphones in hand to take photos with the crookies. Louvard said that he had to hire two extra workers to keep up with demand. And they now make between 1,000 and 1,600 crookies a day. But he seemed weirdly ambivalent about it. He told AFP he has no interest in patenting his invention. And then he said, I mean, it's a bit insane. At some point, you have to stop. It's just some cookie in a croissant. It's not some revolutionary invention. Now, I can attest personally that I'm now getting plenty of targeted videos about how to make homemade crookies. I mean, everybody seems like they want to try them. So I figure that we should give them a test here.
Is that what you've got in that brown bag in front of us on
that
the desk?
That is what I've got in this brown bag.
Jen's brought in a crookie, I believe. Jen,
awesome.
Open it out.
Let's unwrap it.
You ready?
Let's have a look what it's like. So describe what you see, Jen.
Okay, so it basically just looks like a croissant with some cookie dough melted on top.
Isn't that meant to be cooked?
Yeah, it looks a little raw. We're gonna just give
it's
it a
try. It's just a croissant with some cookie dough squashed on top of
it. All
right,
here you go.
I'd say it looks like a splat.
Hold on, you're having some of this, Jen.
Yeah, I've got my own.
Oh, you got your own one, right?
Yeah, you know, these were over €5, right, so I only got it.
We're going to test this crookie now. I'm going to have one bite.
All right, here we go.
Do we need a spitting bin just in case? Oh, bloody hell. That is rich.
That is tooth-rottingly sweet.
Yeah. You wouldn't want to eat a whole one.
It's very, very dense.
Yeah, really heavy stuff, that.
I like it.
Of course you do.
It kind of makes the... Because the nice thing about a croissant is, you know, it's kind of flaky and light, but this makes it very dense.
It's a lot more cookie than croissant, I think.
Yeah, it is. I agree.
All right.
Yeah, see?
I think
the
I'm
actual
done.
Croissant bit is great. I found a bit here that has no cookie dough on it, and the croissant is great. So this guy makes good croissant, but putting raw...
I'm going in for more, though.
Raw cookie dough in them, I'm not sure is...
Yeah, honestly, I agree. I think you only need half of it. Cookie dough's not meant to be cooked, guys.
Cookies normally get cooked.
Yeah, you're risking salmonella for
Mine's dripping with raw egg. I see. So, yeah. Jen, this has taken off, has it, these cookies?
It has, and... Excuse me, I'll finish chewing.
Take a minute, Jen, to swallow whatever's in there.
Okay, it's interesting to me that this trend has taken off so much because all of the French people I know, including my partner, have been very offended by any bastardization of croissants. But did you know that croissants are not really French to begin with?
Don't be silly, Jen. You've eaten too much crookie. Clearly, of course they're French.
Well, the croissant as we know it actually comes from the Austrian crescent-shaped pastry, the Kipferl. I hope I pronounced that right. And that started showing up in local records as early as the 13th century. So for context, we actually don't see any signs of croissants in Paris until at least 1837. Now, the French croissant is largely credited to a bakery that was opened by a couple of Austrian migrants, August Zeng and Ernest Schwarzer. And they opened up their shop in Paris in the 1830s, and they specialized in pastries and cakes from their homeland, and it's generally agreed upon that they are the ones that popularized the Kipferl in France. And around the same time, the French were sort of going crazy for Austrian pastries, which is why when we talk about, you know, the breakfast pastries we all love, croissant, pain au chocolat, we call them viennoiseries.
So the story of Marie Antoinette bringing croissants to France, that isn't quite true?
Well, seeing as the croissant does not appear in France until at least 40 years after her untimely death, it is very unlikely she brought it to Paris. But to make the Frenchies feel better, you could say that even though they didn't invent the croissant, they did perfect it by making it into the tasty, flaky, buttery pastry that we all know and love. The Austrian version was actually made of bread, and it wasn't until the early 20th century that a French baker came up with a recipe using puff pastry dough, and his recipe specified that the croissant should be rolled up in puff pastry and then laminated with butter, and that's how modern day croissants are made.
All right. Now, look, like I said, it's not the first time people have messed with a croissant. We've had the cronut. You know what the cronut was? This was invented in New York, apparently, a kind of cross between a croissant and a donut. Emma, what's the worst thing you can imagine sticking in a croissant?
I mean, anything. Just stop it. A croissant is a beautiful thing. Don't put anything in it. They don't need anything on them. They don't need jam. They don't need, like, cheese inside or whatever. Just enjoy your delicious, flaky, buttery croissant with a coffee. Okay. Stop this.
Okay, I disagree. There's nothing better than a croissant with avocado and fried egg inside.
Oh, Jesus.
This is it. I'm phoning the Interior Ministry. I'm getting her deported from France. This is
Jen, aren't you applying for French citizenship?
I won't tell them that. My French boyfriend has to walk out of the room when I do that.
I'm not surprised. That sounds horrendous. The only problem I've got with croissants is people dunking them in cafe. Don't understand it. Ruins your coffee, ruins your croissant.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of.
Good. Glad I got back up on that.
Yeah. One thing I would love to know, actually, is how to eat a croissant without ending up with pastry absolutely everywhere. I thought there would be some kind of secret technique that French people use, but if there is, I've not found it so far.
Well, did you know, I believe British supermarket Tesco brought out a range of straight croissants to help people cut them and get less flakes everywhere. That caused controversy, yeah. I nearly ruined the Entente Cordiale.
Again.
Jen, do we have to finish these cookie croissants on the show? I mean, I'm struggling.
You're not obligated.
Okay, thanks, Jen. Right, let's move on to a more serious topic. It was announced this week that the co-founder of France's far-right Front National Party, Jean-Marie Le Pen, has been placed under legal guardianship at the request of his family. The 95-year-old is reportedly in increasingly frail health, and the Régime de Protection Juridique is a relatively common procedure in France for people who can no longer manage their own legal or financial affairs. Jean-Marie Le Pen is no longer involved in frontline politics for the Front National, now named Rassemblement National under his daughter Marine, of course. But that doesn't mean he hasn't had a significant impact on the modern day far right. Emma?
He really has. I mean, normally politicians who make like a big impact start off from within an established group. But Le Pen, he created a party from scratch. And together with his daughter, he's created this political brand that's so recognisable that Le Penist is often used as a shorthand for the far right in France.
OK, we'll get onto his daughter shortly. But first, fill us in a bit more about who Jean-Marie is.
Okay, so he was born in Brittany. He was the son of a fisherman, and his dad died in 1942 when his boat hit a mine when Jean-Marie was just a teenager. He went on to study law and political science at university. He enlisted in the army and he served in Vietnam and Egypt, as well as in Algeria, when he actually re-enlisted in the army and served briefly during the Algerian War of Independence in the 50s. But he also got involved in politics young. He was first elected as an MP at the age of 28. And he got involved in several populist parties before founding, in 1972, the party that would really make his name, the Front National, the National Front. Mm. Initially, a lot of his support came from people who were angry about the outcome of the Algerian War. So just to recap, Algeria was granted independence from France in 1962, following a war that was exceptionally brutal, even by the standards of colonial wars. And actually, Jean-Marie himself has been accused of engaging in torture during his time as a soldier, which he has always denied. But the loss of Algeria was a real blow to France's prestige and its self-esteem. It nearly led to a military coup in France itself. Now, Le Pen himself wasn't involved in the coup attempt, but he did definitely sympathise with the right-wing military leaders who felt that France had been humiliated or betrayed in giving up Algeria. And the whole event provoked a lot of turbulence and violence within mainland France. So Le Pen stood for president five times, 1974, 1988, 1995, 2002 and 2007, each time on platforms that was generally anti-immigration. He was never elected president, obviously, although he has at various times been an MP, a member of the European Parliament and a local elected official. Mm. But the time he came the closest was in 2002 when he reached the second round of the presidential election. And this was a huge shock at the time. It was not expected. We saw more than a million people took to the streets to protest over the idea of a President Le Pen. And in the second round, Jacques Chirac, who was the incumbent, won with a very large majority. And that was probably the high point of Jean-Marie Le Pen's personal career. But his party has gone from strength to strength. It was taken over in 2011 by his daughter Marine. In 2015, she expelled her father from the party. But the party itself has continued to grow. And Marine has come second in both of the last two presidential elections. And her party now commands around 30% of the vote in France.
That's interesting. Marine Le Pen expelled her father, Jean-Marie, from the Front National Party. Why?
Well, it's really about a difference in style. So since she took over, Marine Le Pen has worked hard on what she calls the de-diabolisation of the party, basically detoxifying its image. She renamed it, so it's now called Rassemblement National, and she's kind of tried to push the anti-immigration message in economic rather than racial terms. Her focus is on winning elections. And if that means she has to tone down the message, or at least tone down the presentation of the message to do so, then she will do that. Jean-Marie, on the other hand, has always styled himself as a kind of political street fighter. And actually, in his student days, he was an actual street fighter because he belonged to this organisation that got into brawls with leftist students. But he's always seemed to delight in kind of saying the unsayable and trying to shock. He's been repeatedly convicted in court for racist and anti-Semitic remarks. He dismisses the Holocaust as a, quote, detail of history. And he defends France's Nazi collaborationist Vichy government. And basically, Marine decided that he was a liability. They do reportedly now talk to each other again after a period of estrangement. But actually, Rassemblement National itself, despite the expulsion of Jean-Marie, is still run along the lines of a family firm or maybe a mafia organisation. Most of the party bigwigs are people who have personal connections to the Le Pen family.
OK, before we bring in John to get his views on Jean-Marie Le Pen, Emma, things haven't always been smooth in the Le Pen family home either. As you can imagine, there have been a few tense moments over the years.
Yeah, I mean, even before she expelled her father from the party that he had founded, there was tension between the two. Reportedly, the incident that prompted Marine to move out of the family home is when one of Jean-Marie's dogs killed one of her cats. Must have been awkward.
Ouch, yeah.
And Marine's parents, they split up a long time ago, and her mother, in a reportedly in an act of revenge against Jean-Marie, posed nearly nude for Playboy magazine. A photo shoot that Marine apparently found quite traumatising. I think we can all empathise with that if with no other aspect of herself or her politics. We can all imagine the horror of seeing your mum like
strange.
That.
Okay, let's bring back John. John, can Jean-Marie Le Pen be given any credit for shaking up French politics, or for the fact his daughter is considered by many to be the favourite to become the next French president?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, that. I mean, you know, while he was at the head of the Front National, as it was then, Yes, they had a certain influence, and they did introduce topics into French discourse which hadn't been before. Immigration and so on had been always somewhat steered around by the mainstream parties before he put it on the agenda. But really, he never really had the impact on French politics that his daughters had, and we can explain why later. There was just that one moment when he by accident almost got into the second round of the presidential election in 2002 with a very low score and just pushing out Lionel Jospin, the French, the socialist leader, by a very small score. And that's caused a great sort of shock and sort of revulsion and against the Front National as it was then. But his daughter has been much more effective in pushing hard right, far right politics than he was, partly by abandoning many of the things that he did. There is a huge difference between the two. I would summarize it by saying that Jean-Marie, who I met once or twice and once sued me, was a sincere racist. You know, he believed in that kind of thing. I don't think Marine Le Pen is a sincere racist. She's a cynical racist. She's using it politically. She's a much more classic politician in that sense than her father was. But it doesn't make her less dangerous. It makes her more dangerous, in my view.
John, I can't let you go without explaining why Jean-Marie Le Pen sued you.
Well, I wrote an article about Marine, actually, when she was just rising within that party. I said, well, I shouldn't repeat it maybe, but I will. I said that he, as a young man, had partly made money by investing in pornographic literature. And it turned out it wasn't pornographic, it was erotic literature that he invested in. And so the difference between pornographic and erotic was sort of a great subject in a French court, and I was fined €1, I think, at the end of the day, having defamed Jean-Marie Le Pen. But I'm very proud of that, to find another.
That's a great claim to fame.
Yes, that's right. And also something original, all the things that are shot against Jean-Marie Le Pen. No one else had ever thought that before, but I was technically wrong, I agree.
Fair enough. Thanks for explaining, John, and thanks for your explanation about Jean-Marie Le Pen.
Right, we've covered croissants, trains, the Le Pens, and the Entente Cordiale, the final subject this week, the sexy one I referred to in the intro. It is about taxes, of course. It's tax declaration season in France. Is there anything new about this year's tax declaration, Emma?
I'm glad I'm not the only person who finds tax sexy. I think it's really cool, but yeah. I think this is maybe why I don't get invited to many parties anymore. So yes, if you've done your tax declaration before, you will notice there is something new this year. When you get to the end of the form, there will be an extra compulsory questionnaire which will ask you about property that you own. Now, this is only property in France. You don't have to declare if you own property in another country, although if you rent out property in another country, you will need to declare the income from that. But the tax office says that the new section is a reminder to French property owners about the property tax declaration, which you may remember was a new requirement last year.
Yeah.
Basically, if you don't own property in France, just tick no on the questionnaire and that should be the end of it. If you do own property in France, the questionnaire will then ask you if you completed the property tax declaration last year and whether anything has changed since then. So if there have been changes, like for example, you've bought or sold a property since then, or you've changed its use, so like what was a second home has now become your main home, then you will be redirected to the property tax declaration, which is a separate form just to make those relevant changes.
Okay.
Other than that, the process should be largely as last year. If it's your first time declaring, you will find an article on the local website explaining everything from how to get your numéro fiscal, which is the tax number, and then setting up your account on the government website.
Okay. Now, foreign residents in France, foreign workers often make mistakes with their declaration. Jen, can we pick out a few of the common ones to avoid?
Well, I'd say the first that's the most common is just not realizing that you're a tax resident to begin with and that you have to do a declaration. France defines tax residency based on a few different factors, and it's not entirely connected to your residency for immigration purposes. A lot of people think that there's this hard and fast rule that says if you spend less than 6 months a year in France, that you can avoid being a tax resident and having to do a declaration. But French tax authorities consider you a tax resident if you fit into any of these categories. One, you live in France. Two, you work or earn any kind of income in France. And three, you have the center of your economic interests here. So if you fit any of those categories, then you're a tax resident. Living in France is generally defined as spending at least 6 months a year here and having France as your main place of residence. So second homeowners who want to avoid becoming French tax residents can limit their time to less than 6 months a year. But then you still have to think about those other factors. So let's say you have most of your investments in France. Well, that could make you a tax resident in the eyes of tax authorities. And then I'd say the second common mistake also has to do with not realizing you need to fill out a declaration, because earning income in France also includes rental income. So if you put your French property on Airbnb a few weeks out of the year, then you do have to declare those earnings to the French tax man. And there are a few more steps to renting out on Airbnb, but the general rule of thumb is that if you earn rental income, then you have to declare it.
Okay, so not realizing you're a tax resident, forgetting to declare rental income. What's the other common mistake, Jen?
I would say the third is failing to declare your foreign bank accounts. Mm. So in France, you have to declare all of your income, your global income. That doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be taxed on it. You just have to tell them about it. If your country has a dual tax agreement with France, then there's a good chance that you're going to be protected from paying tax twice. And the same principle goes for bank accounts. So even if they're dormant, even if they've got a few coins in them and not much else, you still need to tell the French tax man about it. They don't care about the amount. They just want to know the account number and when you opened it, really. The situation is a little bit confusing for internet bank accounts. If the account has an IBAN number that starts with FR, then it's French and you don't have to worry about declaring it. But if the IBAN number starts with different initials like GB for the UK or BE for Belgium, then yes, you do have to declare it. And if you fail to declare your foreign bank account to the French tax authorities and they find out that you have one, then you can get hefty fines. So don't forget this step.
Mm. Emma, we often talk about the French tax man and we kind of say, yes, he can be a bit greedy, takes a lot, but he's generally a fairly decent bloke. But what happens if you don't declare?
Well, don't anthropomorphize this, Ben. There's one person who is involved in this. Right, it's an entire system. But anyway, let's move on. So, yeah, okay. So there are two common scenarios. So the first is people who are registered and do declare, but they just missed the deadline 1 year because, I don't know, they forgot or they were busy or something. The deadline to do your declaration is either May or June, depending which department you live in. And the second scenario is people who don't register themselves to declare because they don't realize that they have to. So as Jen said, basically everyone living in France has to do the declaration, but it's not uncommon for people not to realize they have to, especially British people, because in the UK, you only do a tax declaration if you're self-employed or you have extra income. So often Brits assume that they don't have to, especially if they're living on a pension from the UK and they have no French income. So if you realize that you haven't registered yourself correctly, the key thing is to contact them before they contact you. You'll definitely be treated more leniently if you just reach out, fess up that you were wrong, and ask them for help in putting it right. As I said, it's a fairly common scenario. If you have no income in France, you probably won't owe much or even any French tax. So it's usually just a question of getting yourself properly registered in the system and filling out the forms. So you can visit your local tax office on a walk-in basis. You don't need an appointment. The staff are usually surprisingly friendly and helpful, and they'll often even help you fill out the paperwork if you're struggling with it. But if you leave it till they catch up with you, you probably are going to be facing late fees, especially if you do actually owe tax.
Now, last year, despite kind of being involved in a website that writes lots and lots of articles and info about taxes in France, I somehow managed to miss the deadline and I did end up paying. What happens if you miss the deadlines?
I still don't understand how you did that, because we must have published about 30 articles on it last year.
It is one of these things you just keep putting off and then, yeah, I missed it.
So if you miss the deadline, you'll be charged a late fee, but exactly how much depends on how late you are and how much tax you pay in France. So if you don't pay taxes at all in France, for example, you earn under the threshold or your income comes from overseas, then it's just a flat fee of €150. If you do pay tax in France, then the charge is a percentage of your outstanding tax bill. So if you pay within 30 days of the deadline, it's 10%. After 30 days, you get a reminder notice, another one, and then the fee jumps up to 20%. And then after another 30 days, it goes up again. If you still just refuse to make the declaration, the tax office does have the power to estimate your tax liability and just charge you that amount. Mm. But helpfully, one thing that you do have in France is the right to make a mistake. It's a legal right. So if you realise after filing that you've made a mistake or you've missed something, you can go back to the declaration and you can alter it at any time until December without attracting any kind of penalty.
Fantastic. Great info, Emma. Great advice, Jen, as always. And that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Unless you want to stay with us and listen in silence as we try and finish these cookies over the next half an hour. I'm struggling with mine, Jen, but thanks for bringing them in. Listeners, we're on a week's break next week, so we'll be back with more talking points from France in 2 weeks' time. Thanks to you all for tuning in once again.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.